Please turn your Bibles to 2 Chronicles chapter 35. This is the second chapter on Josiah in the book of Chronicles, the second and final chapter, and I'll read the whole thing. Now Josiah kept a Passover to the Lord in Jerusalem, and they slaughtered the Passover lambs on the 14th day of the first month. Then he set the priests in their duties and encouraged them for the service of the house of the Lord. Then he said to the Levites who taught all Israel, who were holy to the Lord, "Put the holy ark in the house which Solomon the son of David, king of Israel, built. It shall no longer be a burden on your shoulders. Now serve the Lord your God and his people Israel. Prepare yourselves according to your father's houses, according to your divisions, following the written instruction of David, king of Israel, and the written instruction of Solomon, his son. And stand in the holy place according to the divisions of the father's houses of your brethren, the lay people, and according to the division of the father's house of the Levites. So slaughter the Passover offerings, consecrate yourselves, and prepare them for your brethren, that they may do according to the word of the Lord by the hand of Moses." Then Josiah gave the lay people lambs and young goats from the flock, all for Passover offerings, for all who were present, to the number of 30,000, as well as 3,000 cattle. These were from the king's possessions. And his leaders gave willingly to the people, to the priests and to the Levites. Hilkiah, Zechariah, and Jehiel, rulers of the house of God, gave to the priests for the Passover offerings 2,600 from the flock and 300 cattle. Also Conaniah, his brothers, Shemaiah, Nethanel, and Hashabiah, and Jeiel, and Jozabad, chief of the Levites, gave to the Levites for Passover offerings 5,000 from the flock and 500 cattle. So the service was prepared, and the priests stood in their places, and the Levites in their divisions, according to the king's command. And they slaughtered the Passover offerings, and the priests sprinkled the blood with their hands, while the Levites skinned the animals. Then they removed the burnt offerings, that they might give them to the divisions of the fathers' houses of the lay people, to offer to the Lord, as it is written in the book of Moses. And so they did with the cattle. Also they roasted the Passover offerings with fire, according to the ordinance. But the other holy offerings they boiled in pots and cauldrons and in pans and divided them quickly among all the lay people. Then afterward they prepared portions for themselves and for the priests, because the priests, the sons of Aaron, were busy in offering burnt offerings and fat until night. Therefore the Levites prepared portions for themselves and for the priests, the sons of Aaron. And the singers, the sons of Asaph, were in their places, according to the command of David, Asaph, Heman, and Jeduthun, the king's seer. Also the gatekeepers were at each gate. They did not have to leave their position, because their brethren, the Levites, prepared portions for them. So all the service of the Lord was prepared the same day, to keep the Passover and to offer burnt offerings on the altar of the Lord, according to the command of King Josiah. And the children of Israel who were present kept the Passover at that time and the Feast of Unleavened Bread for 7 days. There had been no Passover kept in Israel like that since the days of Samuel the prophet. And none of the kings of Israel had kept such a Passover as Josiah kept, with the priests and the Levites and all Judah and Israel who were present, and the inhabitants of Jerusalem. In the 18th year of the reign of Josiah, this Passover was kept. After all this, when Josiah had prepared the temple, Necho, king of Egypt, came up to fight against Carchemish by the Euphrates, and Josiah went out against him. But he sent messengers to him, saying, "What do I have to do with you, king of Judah? I have not come against you this day, but against the house with which I have war. For God commanded me to make haste. Refrain from meddling with God, who is with me, lest he destroy you." Nevertheless, Josiah would not turn his face from him, but disguised himself so that he might fight with him, and did not heed the words of Necho from the mouth of God. So he came to fight in the valley of Megiddo. And the archers shot King Josiah. And the king said to his servants, "Take me away, for I am severely wounded." The servants therefore took him out of that chariot and put him in the second chariot that he had, and they brought him to Jerusalem. So he died and was buried in one of the tombs of his fathers. And all Judah and Jerusalem mourned for Josiah. Jeremiah also lamented for Josiah. And to this day all the singing men and the singing women speak of Josiah in their lamentations. They made it a custom in Israel, and indeed they are written in the laments. Now the rest of the acts of Josiah and his goodness, according to what was written in the law of the Lord, and his deeds from first to last, indeed They are written in the book of the kings of Israel and Judah. The account then of Josiah ends here, and the first verse of the next chapter maybe really belongs to chapter 35, as it speaks of the succession to his son. The connection, the context here, of course, is the reforms that Josiah instituted in chapter 34, and the cleansing of the temple, the removing of the idolatry in the land, and especially the finding of the book of the law. And to see that finding of the book of the law as an explicit context for the Passover, I thought I would just read one verse from 2 Kings. I wasn't anticipating having a marker board yet. 2 Kings, which has a parallel account in chapter 23, makes this statement. Now then the king commanded all the people, saying, "Keep the Passover to the Lord your God, as it is written in this book of the covenant." So there he's referring to the book that they found called the Book of the Covenant. And so it's really in the context of that rediscovery of the book, some portion of the first five books of Moses, probably, if not the whole thing. It's in that context, then, that they turn to the celebration of the Passover. Now, it occurred in the same year. You notice in verse 19 that I read there. Sorry, we're back to 2 Chronicles 35. In verse 19, it says, "In the 18th year, this Passover was kept." Well, that was the year that was marked before as the year of the finding of the book of the law. So it was a busy year. It was a great year. And so after that account, there's really nothing given of the life of Josiah in detail until the end of his life, when he goes out to fight against Pharaoh Necho. And that's the last portion of the chapter. So what I'd like to do is to divide our time looking first at the Passover. And I'll try to do that fairly briefly. There are a lot of details here which would be interesting if we tried to think about in what sense they were, you know, prefigurings of Christ and his work, but the usual excuse. I don't have time to go into all the details, even if I were qualified to do it. So I'm just going to try to summarize somewhat briefly the Passover, and then look at the last part about his death. And I'd like to have a little time to reflect on Josiah's life and something of the significance of it at the end. So that's the extra half hour I was trying to buy. We'll see. Anyway, it was a great celebration of the Passover. And that's noted in particular at the end of the passage in verse 18. There had been no Passover like that since the days of Samuel, or as King says, since the time of the judges, Samuel being really at the end of the period of the judges. So it was a tremendous celebration of the Passover, I think largely because of the context out of which it had come. I mean, just think about it. We'd had his grandfather Manasseh ruling for over 50 years in a very corrupt and wicked way. Although he repented at the end, yet he promoted great idolatry. And then Manasseh's son, Amon, who was Josiah's father, even in his brief reign, tried to redo what his father had tried to undo in promoting idolatry again. And so it was a remarkable thing that God would raise up a man like Josiah. Against all odds, you might say, in a worldly sense, that a man like that should come along and by God's grace accomplish such great things. And so I think that's especially probably the sense in which it was a unique Passover, although there are other aspects. There are a large number of offerings mentioned here, about twice as many as under Hezekiah, which was the last great Passover we saw mentioned. And the other thing I guess I'd like to point out in terms of the overall picture is the emphasis that we're not surprised at anymore, I guess, and that is the fact that in all that they did, they were guided by the law. So I noted several verses here. Note, for example, verse 4. They were supposed to prepare themselves, it said, following the written instruction of David, king of Israel, and the written instruction of Solomon, his son. Now, I don't think we have exactly that written instruction in our canonical books, but the point is still that they were following the authority of God in that. In verse 6, for example, they were supposed to follow this preparation again, and it says that they may do according to the word of the Lord by the hand of Moses. Verse 10, they stood in their places according to the king's command, and so it goes. Verse 12, and they said they did it as it is written in the book of Moses. Verse 15 and verse 16. This, as I said, is no surprise, but since this is the last positive example in the book of Chronicles, it is the next to the last chapter too, it's helpful to remember that that theme runs through Chronicles. The emphasis that that faithful worship is worship which pays attention to God's commands and which seeks to serve Him. The other factor that usually accompanies that in Chronicles, and which we could see even in Hezekiah's great Passover. In Hezekiah's Passover, there's an emphasis on following the law, but there's also an emphasis on the rejoicing that took place. And as Mr. Wilkinson noted last week, that's absent from this passage. It's not a good idea in general to argue from silence, but it's so prevalent a pattern throughout Chronicles that I think it's fairly plain that given the hearts of the people that were still more or less given over to idolatry, if not an actual practice, at least by inclination, I think it is significant that there's no mention of the great rejoicing that took place. Although to balance it out a little bit, there is an emphasis on the generosity of the leaders in terms of providing for the sacrifices. So, as Bruce pointed out last time, this is a tough job. Here you're the king, you're leading the Reformation, and these people in their hearts are really just... Ultimately, upon reflection, you can say they were just waiting for him to go. They didn't like what he was doing. So that's a general overview of it. I'd like, in accordance with my rushing along for the Passover, to note just a few things, and then I'll let you get a word in edgewise. You notice in verse 3, there's the reference to the Levites who taught all Israel. And that, again, is a theme that you can trace through the scriptures, that it was the responsibility of the priests and Levites to instruct the people. And Josiah, as a faithful king, encourages them to their work. That's actually in verse 2, right? Doing things a little out of order. In verse 2, he encourages them to do the work. Again, as the faithful king does, he can't take the place of the priests and Levites. He can't offer sacrifices. But God has given him the authority to encourage them to do their work and to call them to their duty. And so he calls them to prepare themselves to set themselves apart. Those ideas of preparation and sanctification come up in this passage more than once. There is a kind of an odd thing, which I'm sure you'd ask about if I didn't say anything about, so I'll try to make a comment here. In verse 3, there's a reference to the ark. And it says, and most translations say something like, you shall no longer carry it around on your shoulders. And it's a little puzzling because, well, they weren't supposed to carry it around on their shoulders, right? That was the point of having a temple, of a settled place of worship, that they weren't in the tabernacle anymore. They didn't have to move from place to place. So why did he tell them, you don't have to move it anymore? Well, it's not, I try to come in with a definite answer when I have one, but this is pretty unclear in my mind. It could be that what Ammon, in particular Manasseh, Ammon's father, had done was to actually take the ark out of its place. Remember, there's a reference to putting a carved image in the temple, and it could well be that the greatest sacrilege, which would be to go into the Holy of Holies and remove the ark and put this in its place. And that could be what's referred to here. There also, with the Hebrew, there's some variations in the way you could translate the tense, and so it could be just the fact that they're supposed to be teaching and ministering now. They're not looking back in the time of the wilderness wanderings when they had to do that. So there's an emphasis on the change in their ministry. We hope we'll be satisfied with that and move on. But that is he does make the transition from 3 to 4 to emphasize what they are to do, and there's an emphasis on the work of preparing for the Passover and the offerings that are made. And they did do it. As you read on to the chapter, you can see, especially in verses 10 through 16, that they were ready and they worked willingly at this. The other thing that I've already noted, I guess, is in verses 7 through 9, and that's the generosity of Josiah, and not only of Josiah, but also the ecclesiastical leaders and providing for the people. This is probably a time of relative poverty in the nation, and here the people are provided for by the royal authority as well as by the, you might say, the church authorities in terms of providing for the offerings that are made. And there are large numbers, as I mentioned, described in verses 7 through 9. That last part, 10 through actually it goes down to verse 19, gives some of the details of the offerings. And that's the part I said, okay, well, I'm not going to go into too much detail about. It talks about how the Passover offerings were to be roasted, and the other offerings, which would have accompanied the Passover, were to be prepared in their own way. And only a couple of things I want to point out here. First of all, in verse 15 is the emphasis again that even in the service of music, there's a reference to the fact that this is a command from God. The singers are in their places according to the command of David, Asaph, Heman. And interestingly enough, Jeduthun again is called a prophet. The ones whom God provided for the ministry of music were prophetic. I mean, in the biblical sense of prophetic, they provided inspired music for the worship of God. And that we saw already back in 1 Chronicles 25. The other thing that's a striking aspect, and I'd like to use to summarize this, is the emphasis that it was all of Israel. And what verse is that in? I've lost my place. I didn't know which verse it was. One of these verses talks about Judah and Israel both being involved. And someone needs to help me here. I guess I lost it. Sorry. I thought I'd noted which verse that was. Thank you. Thank you. That's it. Yeah, all Judah and Israel were present. Now, of course, as we noted, the term Israel can be used just for the southern kingdom, but especially, it can be used in different ways, but I think the fact that he said Judah and Israel is to emphasize that even the north was included in this. And so, in effect, the Assyrians had lost the control in terms of the, at least we hope, a large number of the people and their religious affiliation. So they were involved. So if I could just reflect for a moment on the significance. The Passover was intended to be largely a celebration, of course, of their deliverance, but it was also there to emphasize the unity of God's people. And the fact that this is one of the three, but certainly the main feast where all the people gathered together in Jerusalem. Some of the other feasts you could see in the outlying areas, but here they gathered together a feast for other aspects of their service. But here they gathered together, and that emphasis on the unity of the Passover carries over, of course, to the New Testament, where the Passover is fulfilled in the Lord's Supper. And Paul emphasizes, you know, we all partake of one loaf. We're all one body. And that's, I think, if you want to look beyond maybe some of the details which were fulfilled in Christ and see the larger picture, it's that blessing of Josiah, who becomes a picture of Christ as the faithful king who rules and restores God's worship, and who gathers together God's people who were scattered and brings them together in faithful worship of God. And I think that's part of the beauty of the passage, even if, you know, in the end the people's hearts turned out to be less than enthusiastic about all this. The fact that they were united in this is a significant thing. Well, end of the 25-minute monologue. Any comments or questions down to verse 19? Bruce.
Just wondering about the supplying of offerings from Josiah, but particularly from the chief of the Levites. Were they allowed to gather that much wealth?
I don't think there was. I don't know of any restriction on what they could raise on their family farm ranch.
I'm just thinking about typical of unrighteous government, which they had previous 50-some years. Usually, the extraction of a lot of corruption and extraction of a lot of wealth from the populace to the.
Yeah. So thinking back to the church history class at the time of the Reformation, you know, the Roman Church was very wealthy, and that was an ill-gotten gain. But the money was given back to the people, and maybe that's what you're getting at.
Yeah, why they were supplying.
It could be. Yeah.
It was, I mean, obviously this worship was corrupt. The government was corrupted.
Yeah, I don't know if they were selling
as well, but right. It was a little gotten.
They had indulgences of some kind. Yeah, that's an interesting point. I don't know. Any other comments? Okay. Well, I'd like to then look at the last part, which is the death of Josiah. It's he reigned for 31 years altogether, so this is about 13 years after the events we just described, and it says that he marches out against Necho, king of Egypt. So Necho is a well-known historical figure. There are actually two Nechos, Pharaoh Necho 1 and 2, but the historical situation is a little interesting and somewhat complicated. Okay, so bear with me here. I'm going to wave my hands. I should have had a map, but remember that the Assyrians had been the dominant party until relatively recently in that part of the world. And the Assyrian dominance was being weakened, especially by Babylon. So within, you know, this is about, what's described here is about 609 BC. So within 25 years, less than 25 years, Jerusalem would fall to the Babylonians. So you can see that the transition of power is occurring. And the Assyrians are still seeking to regain control or hold control against the Babylonians. What is Pharaoh Necho doing? Well, the Egyptian king is going out to help the Assyrians fight against the Babylonians. Okay, so he is going up to assist against the Babylonians. And where he's, the place where he's going is described here as Carchemish. Carchemish is actually a fairly famous city in terms of ancient Near East. It's on the Euphrates River. It's at the fords, the most convenient place to cross the Euphrates rivers and Euphrates River. And so it's a very strategic spot. And so he's marching up there to prevent the Babylonians from getting control of Carchemish. Because if they get control of Carchemish, it's all over as far as he's concerned. So that's what he's doing. And the irony of it, of course, is that what is Josiah doing when he goes up to resist Necho? Well, ultimately, he's helping the Babylonians. I mean, that's what he would be doing, helping the Babylonians in this. Whether he was pro-Babylonian or anti-Assyrian, it all gets very complicated. Talk to Mr. Covington about military history. It's all very complicated. But in any case, that's the way things were arranged. And in fact, what turned out is that about 5 years later, 4 or 5 years later, Carchemish did fall to the Babylonians. The Babylonians came over and in a surprise attack really took Carchemish from the Egyptians. And that was, it's a very famous point in history because that's where the Babylonians got access to the western part of the former Assyrian kingdom. And that's why they could come down then and take Jerusalem within a short period of time. So it's a very strategic situation that Josiah tries to put himself in the middle of. And I suppose you could say at first glance, it's a reasonable thing to try to do. But this is consistent with the pattern of the godly kings, even the best. That is that at the end of the life, there's a failure noted. And this is pretty clearly a failure. Although, like in the case of Hezekiah, how seriously you should criticize Josiah's, I don't know, it's a little bit hard to say. He receives a strange word from God. Maybe the word isn't strange, but the way he receives it is strange. God speaks to him through Necho, it says in verse 22. The Pharaoh has to get to Carchemish. The simplest way is to go up the seacoast, and this is where I need the map, to go up the coast along the Mediterranean Sea. But at some point he has to cut across the northern part of Josiah's kingdom. It's actually the northern kingdom, but Josiah claimed it for his own. And Megiddo would be in that vicinity where he would have to cut across. And Necho basically says, look, I'm not picking any fights. I'm just on my way to this battle. I'm not going to cause any trouble. Don't get involved in this. And Josiah, that's a paraphrase, of course, but Josiah, and after receiving the word in verse 21, it says in verse 22, nevertheless, Josiah would not turn his face from him, but disguised himself and went up to the battle. There's something kind of, you know, if ominous is the right word, but about the description, it may sound familiar. This is exactly what Ahab did, right? Ahab had a word of warning. He went anyway. He disguised himself. This is a long time ago in Chronicles, but remember when he, this is Ahab of the northern kingdom, went up, he disguised himself, and it says he was shot. There it says, at a venture. And here you get something of the same sense that an archer shot him. It doesn't say at a venture or at random. But in any case, he was shot and wounded. And so that too, I think, lends to the sort of aura of unfaithfulness in what he did. And who was mortally wounded then and taken back to Jerusalem where he was buried. That's the concluding account of Josiah's life. And there's the notation in verse 25 that I'd really like to, this is the part I want to reflect on some, that he was mourned greatly in verse 24. All Judah and Jerusalem mourned for Josiah. So the part I said before about their hoping he would be dead has to be qualified in the light of the reaction of the people. Their later behavior makes you wonder exactly where their hearts were. But it says in verse 25, I think we know where Jeremiah's heart, Jeremiah the prophet, who was a close advisor to Josiah, and who knew